Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
It's the Disruption Zone. I am Leland Conway. How do we get beyond this sort of generational thing that seems to be happening where socialism is something that people want? Like, to me, I look at socialism and I go, that is dumb on its face. You know, and it's so funny because I understand why people are gravitating to it. It sounds good at first glance, but as my mom always taught me, you should always take a second glance and make sure. And when you look under the hood of socialism, it's very dumb. I personally think it's dumb on its face, but that's because I've been educated in how it works. People think that socialism is eschewing, if you will, the profit society, you know, the big corporations making all the money and taking it away from the little guy. When in fact, it's actually the exact same thing as crony capitalism once it gets distorted, and it will get distorted. It just has a different currency, right? Like when capitalism gets distorted, it gets distorted with crony capitalism. The government gets into bed with private businesses. They work together to exclude competition. The little guy gets screwed. And that's happened. And that's a real concern. And it's part of what drives massive inequality, right? So we should get back to actual free markets. Socialism works the exact same way, but with a different currency. Instead of with money, it's political power. And so it distorts the system via political power. So you're still going to have an elite group. During Stalin's rise, the artists and the communicators, and they didn't want to get beheaded. They didn't want to get put in a chamber. They didn't want to get shot. So what they did is they entertained the elites, and they helped the elites push their propaganda. It's very similar to what we're seeing now with the left-wing media. And this was how they got accepted, and they got to travel around to they called them dakas. They were basically resort homes that Stalin had. Now, how could a guy who claimed to be for the little man have all these resort homes that he went to? Well, then the elite got to go and hang out with him and talk about how bad the plight of the little man was while Stalin was loading the little man, farmers who dared to grow their own potatoes for themselves, onto trains and sending them off to be killed. Like, that's the distortion of the socialist system. It's way worse because what happens in the capitalist system when it gets sort of distorted is people get poor sometimes if it gets distorted. But what happens in socialism when it gets distorted is that people get killed, right? I would rather have the poor than the killed. But that being said, there's a better way to do capitalism, and that's a more pure way to do capitalism. And there's an honorable way to achieve profit. And with that, I want to welcome on the next guest to the podcast, The Disruption Zone, James R. Otteson, PhD. He's a philosopher and political economist at Wake Forest University. He wrote a book called Honorable Business, A Framework for Business in a Just and Humane Society. And he will be at the Center for Free Enterprise at the University of Louisville on January 30th at 4:30 p.m. in the PNC Horn Auditorium. And if you miss that, and you're listening to this podcast after that actually happened, go Google his TED Talk, but it's pretty awesome. Or buy one of his books because they're awesome as well. So we want to welcome onto the program James Otteson. Thanks for coming on, sir. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me.
So you're going to be here in Louisville and talking about your book, A Framework for Business in a Just and Honorable Society. It's interesting to me because when I look around at business, it really almost shocks me how the almost lack of importance of the customer and how the customer is treated in today's world. Do you concur with that? Do you see a sort of a lopping off or a dropping off of putting the customer first in business?
Yeah, I think there is a lot of that, and I think it's reflected in the wider sentiment, the wider cultural sentiment about business. I mean, if I tell people I teach business ethics, I often get people say, oh, isn't that a contradiction in terms? Is there such a thing as business ethics? But I think part of that is it results from the fact that the bad stories are the ones we hear. What we don't hear are the majority of cases when people have good associations, transactions, exchanges with business. And there is such a thing as honorable business. Not all business is honorable. But there is such a thing as honorable business, and we often don't hear those stories enough. We just hear the negative stuff, and that's what sticks in our mind.
There seems to be there's an element of the business world that's trying to be, for lack of a better term, woke, if you will, to sort of virtue signal its way into people's hearts by saying, look at us, we're politically correct, we're inclusive, we're diverse, we hate Trump, we hate conservatives, blah, 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 blah. And then that's supposed to signal that they are an honorable business. And yet, if you look at it, a lot of times it's really just folks that are disguising what they think is an evil prospect, that is capitalism, which I think is fantastic, but they're afraid of that impression of it in the world. Where do you think that's coming from? Why are there so many people that respond to, like, you know, those types of advertising where companies say, we're not going to do business, we're going to stop selling guns, or we're not going to do business with those conservatives, or anybody with a MAGA hat's not welcome? Why do you think there's a positive response to businesses doing that virtue signaling? Where's that coming from?
Well, I think there's more than one cause of that. You know, and for some of it, I think, you know, businesses are doing what businesses do, which is they're responding to what they think is consumer demand. Mm-hmm. So, you know, businesses are in the, you know, what they want to do is they want to please their customers. And if customers say we want, you know, these kinds of practices or we don't want those kinds of practices, well, businesses are going to respond to that. And I think that's reflected. I mean, one example is, you know, if you think about the increasing over the last several years, the increasing demand on businesses to be green, to be engaging in sustainable environmental practices, a lot of businesses go way beyond what they're actually required to do by regulations or by law to trumpet their, you know, their sustainable and environmental friendly practices. And I think one reason for that is because that's what customers demand. That's what people demand. Mm-hmm. You know, but on the other side of it, you know, just thinking about it from the business perspective, you know, if you look at Hollywood movies, you know, 9 out of 10 Hollywood movies, who is the villain in the movie?
Business.
It's going to be some a CEO of some international company or something. You know, so the wider culture is, you know, they're suspicious of business. And so I think businesses are sensitive to that. They're aware of that. And so for many of them, they want to go over backwards, you know, bend over backwards to try to make them seem as if they're doing something different, honorable, going above and beyond.
But on ironically, you know, recently Ricky Gervais and his Golden Globes monologue, where he dressed down a lot of the quote unquote woke businesses of today, saying, look at you. You know, you're saying this, we're so inclusive on this one side, and you got kids working in sweatshops on the other side. In a way, it's that sort of virtue signaling as a veil against what actually is happening. In other words, the machinations of the business behind that veil of virtue signaling is not that much different than what it is everyone is afraid, which is the reason why they're virtue signaling in the first place.
Yeah, and I think part of that, yeah, it's a good point. I think part of that is, you know, the blame for that falls on business people themselves who don't often make the case for the value that they're contributing to the world. Mm. You know, if business is done honorably, what they're doing is they're not only seeking to benefit themselves, they're seeking to benefit their customers, their clients, you know, their suppliers, everybody, their employees, the people they're dealing with. And a good business seeks to create benefit for all of those people. And I think a lot of businesses and business people are hesitant, maybe for cultural or other reasons, but they're hesitant to make that positive case for the actual value that they're contributing.
Right. Let me play devil's advocate for a minute. And maybe it's not so much devil's advocate or is as just, you know, I always like to stick up for the little guy. I love business. I love capitalism. I love free markets. I think our markets should be more free, not less free. But at the same time, there's actually, I think, a point to what people have in terms of fear or loathing, if you will, of big business, because it has, in fact, done unethical and dishonorable things. I think of the food industry that, you know, it's recently been revealed that, you know, the studies that wrongly demonized fat in our diet were paid for by the sugar industry, the pharmaceutical industry, which everybody is angry at right now, oftentimes hides or manipulates research so that they can sell more pills. There are huge examples of big businesses doing very bad things that I think in some ways there is a legitimate issue that or gripe that people have with that, which I think is probably why you wrote your book.
Yeah, no, I think you put your finger on something important. And, you know, a lot of the kinds of cases that you point to where businesses are engaged in bad behavior, And a lot of the criticisms that people raise to, say, capitalism or to a market economy, commercial society, I think a lot of it is a lot of the core of the criticism is really aimed at what we might call cronyism, where you have businesses or corporations, they get in bed with the regulators or they get in bed with the legislators to get new regulations or to get laws passed that favor the entrenched interests, oftentimes at the expense of others. And those kinds of partnerships, you know, when people talk about business, you know, government, private sector partnerships, those are often very dangerous because when those people, when they get in a room, I mean, Adam Smith said this way back in the 18th century. He said, it doesn't take long for people in an industry to get together and start conspiring against the public.
Right.
But they can't really do much against the public unless they can enlist the help of the government or they can enlist the help of regulators. And there are a lot of businesses and a lot of industries, especially the entrenched companies that, I mean, ironically, they welcome regulation, but, you know, they want to craft the regulation. They want to be at the table crafting it so that they can make it harder for new entrants, harder for competitors, and raise the prices for them so that consumers end up paying.
You said something that makes my ears perk up when you mentioned cronyism. We're talking with Jim Otteson, and he is the author of Honorable Business, a framework for business in a just and honorable society. You mentioned cronyism. I think one of the reasons why we're having such a hard time corralling this drive towards socialism with young people is because capitalism has become so distorted and so easy to demonize because of just that. When it has gotten into bed with the government or when it has gotten into bed and colluded against its own customers, so to speak, we can talk about big data. You know, it was just revealed Vice Magazine had a really interesting article about how there was a major antivirus company that was essentially selling every click you do on the internet. So every website you've ever gone to has been sold now to big companies like Pepsi and all this, and no one told you. You know, I think that let's dive into crony capitalism and why that's making it so difficult to convince young people that freedom and capitalism is a good thing.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, and it's hard to sort out. So when you ask people, what do you think about capitalism, what they think of is the situation we have today where you have, take the United States as an example. In the United States, we have a very large regulatory apparatus that has its hands on virtually every company and every industry in the economy. And, you know, if you're an optimistic person, you might think, well, that's good because there's oversight on all these companies and that will help to make sure that they're doing the right thing and they're not defrauding people or, as you say, colluding against consumers or customers. But on the other hand, you have to remember also, well, who is it who's doing the lobbying of these regulators? Who's doing the lobbying of the legislators? Well, it's not the consumers, it's the companies. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're the ones who are, you know, if you have this regulatory apparatus that's very large, it's in the interest of the companies to spend money and time and energy getting those regulations crafted to protect themselves, to give themselves subsidies, to protect themselves against competition. And so that's what they do. And, you know, from a certain standpoint, you might say, oh, well, that's just rational. They're just, you know, that's the circumstance in which they find themselves, and they're just trying to get the most favorable, you know, arrangement for themselves that they can.
Yeah.
But when you take a larger perspective and look at the overall economy or what's the effect on everybody else, well, you know, a lot of that is negative. And so when you ask young people today, well, you know, what do you think about capitalism? Well, that's what they think of. They think of all of these companies with their thousands of lobbyists who are in bed with the regulators. And, you know, they don't think of free markets. They think of that kind of cronyism. And I think that's a problem.
Why do they not, though, also blame government, the government that they love and claim to turn to? Because those regulations, ultimately, while they get crafted by bureaucrats, oftentimes it's instigated by Congress. And you look at Congress, like if I see something that comes across the news that says Congress today passed the Safe Skies Act, I assume that the airline industry just found a way that they can crash jets without consequences, right? Because it's always the opposite of what the bill actually says. So to your point, when you have businesses go in and they basically go, we need to regulate ourselves in a way that cuts out our competition, right? I mean, that's what people see and they go, what are you doing? But nobody blames Congress.
Yeah, and I mean, you're right. I mean, there is a bit of a puzzle there. You know, people say, well, we want more regulation of business. But if you say, well, are you favoring regulation by Donald Trump and Nancy Pelosi? They say, oh, no, I don't mean those people. I mean experts or
right.
people who are, you know, somebody else. But, you know, I think in some sense, hope springs eternal. We assume that regulations will be enacted, will be crafted and enacted by, you know, people who are objective and independent and maybe have a level of knowledge that's beyond that of most human beings. And we don't tend to think about the actual sausage making that leads to the real regulations. And I think there's also the other issue is that, you know, people don't know very much the history of, you know, socialist attempts at organizing economies in the past. There have been, you know, in the last 100 years, there have been over 24 countries have tried to implement socialism, and it hasn't ended well in any of the cases. But we don't know that history. So we think, well, you know, in the United States, we're going to get it right. We can do it right. We get the right people in. And we always think that the next group of people will be the right people.
We're talking with Jim Unison, who is a philosopher, political economist, Wake Forest University, is an author. You've done a TED Talk, which, by the way, people should Google that and check out your TED Talk because it's awesome. Let's kind of dive. You were kind of going in a direction there that I think a lot of people need to pay attention to. Socialism itself, and you've written books about socialism, the end of socialism. Why is that such a – it's socialism is dumb on its face. Like, it's just dumb on its face, but so many people love it right now. Why?
Well, you know, one reason is because, you know, they tend not to be aware of the experiments that people have run in the name of socialism. There are people today who say, well, even if they know about these experiments that have been run, if you bring up, you know, the Soviet Union or North Korea or Cuba or Venezuela, they say, well, that's not real socialism because, you know, those places are run by power hungry dictators, not the kinds of, you know, more enlightened people that we would like to have in charge. But I also think that there's an emotional appeal. I mean, you know, if what you think socialism is helping people who need help and minimizing vast inequality, well, those sound like good things. And so, you know, if you don't spend too much time thinking about, well, what would we actually have to create that, and what are the likely results of attempting that, then those are emotionally appealing things. And I think that's explains a lot of the appeal. And I think also the other thing that you had mentioned earlier about, you know, if you take millennials, for example, millennials, I think that, you know, they're getting a bit of a raw deal here because a lot of the, you know, the United States federal government is very far in debt. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of regulatory restrictions on new entrants into markets. And these things have benefited older generations and in many cases at the expense of younger generations, including millennials. And so, you know, they have a sense that, hey, we're getting a raw deal here, and they have a point.
Well, exactly, because I think millennials also watched what they thought was capitalism destroy a lot of their parents' retirement in the 2007 crash, which, again, that was a perfect example of crony capitalism, you know, and where the government was getting involved and falsely propping up housing markets, and it just wasn't sustainable, and it all came tumbling down. And falsely blamed was capitalism instead of that cronyism that you talk about. How do we reverse this, though? And I want to come back to honorable business, because I think that's obviously the point of why we're chatting with you. But how do we reverse this where it is becoming so sort of par for the course for people to just go, oh, yeah, socialism, that's a good thing. I like that. You know, is it the hypocrisy of people on the right,
well,
maybe? What is it?
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough nut to crack, to be honest. I mean, I think one way to start it is by, you know, thinking about what could be the purpose of going into business. So, you know, if you think about students who are studying business in college or who are getting MBAs, one of the things they almost never have an opportunity to do is to ask, well, should we have a market economy? What's the purpose of a firm in a market economy? You know, they don't often have the opportunity to ask these larger questions. And, you know, for most of the students in business school, if they're asked, as they are by their, you know, by other students, why are you majoring in business? The assumption is that the only two things you could possibly want to go into business for are to make money or to get a job. Mm-hmm. That there's nothing else that you could want out of business. And, you know, I mean, do they want to make money and get a job? Probably, but that's probably true for all students, not just business students. But still, that's not a very inspiring, purpose or mission. So I think one of the ways to think about it is, well, what would be an inspiring mission? And that's captured in what I argue anyway is this notion of honorable business, where I'm an honorable business person if I pledge to myself that I will only seek ways to benefit myself if at the same time I'm benefiting other people, and it has to be genuine benefit to others. And if I start thinking about my purpose in business in that way, where I'm thinking about, you know, yes, I'll benefit, but only if I'm benefiting others and never at the expense of other people. That's a very different way to think about the reason to go into business. And, you know, if you think about how much prosperity, you know, increasing prosperity, how many problems that can help solve in the world, everything from poverty and hunger to healthcare, increasing prosperity helps all of those things. Pledging to oneself and making a commitment to be an honorable business person can actually help to contribute to those larger problems as well. So I think reframing the purpose of going into business can help change the conception of business people or future business people thinking about students going into business. And I think that's one step in the right direction.
Okay, so this is going back to the old basic exchange. One guy has two helmets, the other guy has two swords. One guy needs a helmet, the other guy needs a sword. We make an exchange; it's profitable for both. You know, it's right. there is the benefit. You know, if I make an extra helmet and I can sell it at a profit, but the guy that buys it needs a helmet, you know, and I trade it for a sword that I needed. Well, voila, we've had a profitable exchange, and both people have benefited from that. And I guess what you're asking, though, and we're talking with James Otteson, political and philosopher and political economist. What you're asking businesses then to do is to not necessarily invert why they go into business, but to sort of change that overall philosophy. It seems almost an impossible task because ultimately they just want the money.
Yeah, and I think you're right. It's a challenging task. But, you know, even that basic insight that you mentioned about the difference between what economists call zero-sum exchange versus positive-sum exchange. You know, if I just steal your laptop from you, well, I benefited, but at your expense. So
right.
It's plus one laptop for me, minus one laptop for you. That's no net increase. That's just a zero-sum exchange. But if I go into Starbucks and I give them $5 for my mocha latte, well, who benefited from that exchange? We both did, because otherwise, if we both didn't benefit, if Starbucks didn't benefit, they would say no. If I didn't benefit, I would say no.
Right.
That seems like a fundamental insight, a basic insight. But that's something that I think is lost on a lot of people because they tend to think that the only people who benefit from those exchanges are the, you know, the richer ones, the company right. benefits, but they don't see the benefit that the individual gets.
Well, if I had a dollar for every time I heard, well, there's Starbucks in there charging $5 for a regular guy to get a cup of, well, don't buy one. Go to McDonald's. You know, it's like you don't have to go in there. You know, I mean,
yeah, and the fact that so many people do suggests that they actually are providing benefit
exactly.
and value for a lot of people.
Exactly. So.
Yeah. And I think that's a really important insight that you know that people tend to forget.
Yeah. Well, how do we get that? Is there a problem in academia? You're in the academic world. You're a guy that I would love to send my kids to college where you were teaching them the economy. But so many many professors of economics are going, you know, they're agging on that sort of hatred of business, and these kids go through 4 years of just getting example after example of, you know, real abuses, but it's not really what capitalism is about. How do we get our schools and universities to start teaching about how the exchange is actually supposed to take place, that positive benefit exchange?
Well, if you can figure that out, maybe you'll get a Nobel Prize. only half joking. I mean, you know, another part of it that we haven't mentioned is that I think we're sort of hardwired by nature to see the world in in zero sum terms. Meaning, if one person gains, we tend to think that must mean that somebody else loses. So we think of wealth and prosperity as being sort of fixed in the world, and it doesn't increase, it doesn't decrease. So if one person becomes a billionaire, the only way that person could become a billionaire is by impoverishing other people. So and I think a lot of people do think that. So if they look at a Jeff Bezos or a Bill Gates or, you know, people who are the wealthiest of the wealthy, their instinctive reaction is that, well, I don't know how you exactly what you did wrong, but I'm sure you did something wrong. And, you know, one of the aspects of, you know, teaching things about honorable business, you know, one of the things that I like to try to get people to think about is, well, it is possible to profit honorably. You know, I can profit by making you better off. You profit too, but maybe in a different way than the way I do. It's not necessarily, in fact, if we did it voluntarily and you're better off and I'm better off, then that should be a good thing. And overall prosperity going up is a good thing.
Right.
You know, and if you think about, you know, Jeff Bezos, for example, it's not as, you know, I don't know how much he's currently estimated to be worth, whatever it is, $120 billion or something. You know, what's a billion among friends? I guess it goes up and down with the price of Amazon. But it's not as if he's walking around with $120 billion in his pocket or buried in the backyard or in a mattress, stuffed in a mattress. That money is invested in Amazon and its employees and stock. And I mean, that's generating wealth throughout the economy.
Right.
Not to mention all the benefit it's providing for the tens of millions of customers of Amazon. So, you know, once we start, if we can start thinking in terms of, you know, positive sum, overall gains, increasing prosperity to all the partners and all the people in an exchange, then I think that can help. You know, that's a truer view of what's going on, but I think it also changes our perspective.
Well, I think one of the issues that we have, and we're talking with James Otteson, a political philosopher and political economist, Wake Forest University, author of Honorable Business. I think one of the places this breaks down, James, is that we see the disparity. We see the Jeff Bezoses of the world, while we also see the people under the bridge pushing shopping carts. And we see that disparity and we go, oh my God, this is awful. But what we forget is that part of that is due to dishonorable business practices. But part of it is also due to the inherent inequality of people, meaning that we are all of equal value, but we're not all of equal talent. I could be the very best podcaster in the country, but I'll probably never make as much in my career as Michael Jordan made during his basketball career. I might be the best plumber in the world and make quite a nice living, but I will never be able to make as much as the best neuroscientist or neurosurgeon in the world, because society itself will place different values on different talents, and some people will be more talented than others in areas. Everybody's got an area of expertise, but that expertise may not be as valuable to society overall. So that's where I think the disparity in the conversation breaks down, because people go, well, that doesn't make any sense, but yet it does.
Yeah, and, you know, I think it's an important point to say that, you know, there is a diversity among people. People are different and they make different choices. And, you know, some people might value, you know, I'm a professor, so some people might value what I offer as a professor more highly than other people, and that's okay. They're going to value what Michael Jordan did or what LeBron James had a much higher rate, I mean, to my chagrin, than what they value me. Right. And so, you know, that's going to be reflected in how much a Michael Jordan or a LeBron James makes as opposed to what I make. I think that's an important point. But I also think it's very important what you said a second ago, which is that, you know, increasing prosperity, you know, it's not equal. We don't all get, you know, all of the increasing prosperity doesn't get distributed equally across society. And there are people who are, even in a wealthy place like the United States, who are below what we might think of as minimally acceptable levels of human dignity. So I think the first point to make is the one you made, which is that everybody has value, and we should view everybody as being equally possessed of human dignity, and we should view all individuals as being people of dignity and value. And then I think, you know, for the people who are below a certain, you know, what we think of as the minimally decent level, what this calls on us is for personal obligations. You know, if
yes.
I see somebody who needs help and I'm in a position to help, I should help.
Right.
I shouldn't wait for somebody else to do it. I shouldn't expect somebody else to do it. I should do it. And, you know, one of the things that can enable me to do that is not just a personal commitment that we all make, but also the increasing prosperity itself. So,
right.
you know, that increasing prosperity means that we have more means to address exactly those problems.
Well said. And I also think, tying back to your book, Honorable Business, if you wake up every morning and your goal is to be honorable, whether it's in business or in family or in faith or whatever it is that you're doing, you're naturally going to see those things and make those corrective actions in society. And if we had more of that, we'd probably be a lot better off.
I agree. Yeah. I couldn't agree more.
Well, your event is going to be fascinating. I want to encourage everybody to check it out. It's tomorrow, Thursday, January 30th, 4:30 p.m. at the PNC Horn Auditorium at the University of Louisville Center for Free Enterprise. The book is Honorable Business, A Framework for Business in a Just and Humane Society. How can people follow you on Twitter, Facebook, social media, et cetera?
I'm on Twitter, and it's the handle is at @JROII. And please feel free to follow me or to reach out to me directly.
Awesome. It was great talking to you. I hope we can have you on again sometime.
I would love that. Thank you very much.
Fantastic. Thank you, James. Fascinating stuff. And I think he's got real insight. As a professor, we need more like him, touting the virtues of capitalism and honorable capitalism, because it can be honorable. And if we can get back to that idea that while we are bettering ourselves, we want to also better others, we'll all be a lot better off. And I just think this is fascinating stuff, and we need more conversations like that. But hey, that's why you come to the Disruption Zone, right? We'll have more episodes coming up soon. I am Leland Conway, The Disruption Zone, www.thedisruptionzone.com. You like how I did that? It's just like, that's the old man way of saying a website. You're not supposed to say www anymore. All right, check us out, thedisruptionzone.com. We're on Twitter at The Disruption Zone, and also at Leland Show. We're on Instagram with at Greatly Londo and at Disruption Zone, and on Facebook, The Disruption Zone. Thanks for listening.